Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 1. Dean Hovey, the author of Whistling Sousa, has given us permission to use Whistling Sousa in our broadcasts. His only request was that we mention he has other books in the Whistling series. They are Whistling Wings, Whistling Up a Ghost, Whistling Pirates, and coming in 2022, Whistling Bake Off. Whistling Sousa, like Whistling Pines, was set in two harbors. Mr. Hovey has taken a few liberties with some of the details of our town, but overall, it is an entertaining story, and I think that you will enjoy hearing a rip-roaring good story set in our town. Hovey has indicated that his books are available online through Amazon.com. Whistling Sousa, A Whistling Pines Mystery by Dean L. Hovey. This book is a work of fiction. The events, places, and people are fictional products of the author's imagination or are used fictionally. Any resemblance to actual events is coincidental and unintended. Copyright 2013 by Dean Hovey. Dedicated to Frank S. Hovey, Major, USMC, 1920 to 2012. Prologue. The four-day Lake County Fair is held each August in Two Harbors, Minnesota, near the western tip of Lake Superior. It isn't a big event in terms of acreage or even the number of attractions, but when you live in a rural Minnesota county extending from the frigid north shore of Lake Superior to the nearly Arctic Canadian border, any summer event draws huge crowds. The fair serves as the regional clearinghouse for 4-H projects. The winners take their projects, whether animal or craft, to St. Paul, also known as the Cities, to compete at the 10-day Minnesota State Fair. For many of the rural teens, the 3-hour, 180-mile drive to the State Fair is their first trip south of Duluth and their first chance to realize there is a larger pool of future spouses than just the people they've known since kindergarten. Fairgoers from tiny towns trust their neighbors, leave their houses unlocked, and walk the fairgrounds without a thought about crime. None suspect that a murderer is among them. Chapter 1. Thursday. Everyone loves a day at the fair, and the residents of Whistling Pines, the senior citizen assisted living facility located in Two Harbors, are no exception, many of them having attended every county fair since childhood. The living arrangements at Whistling Pines range from apartments with meals provided to people who live independently but require assistance with their medications and personal care. The more mobile residents drive themselves and friends to the fairgrounds. Other residents are driven by friends and relatives. The rest rely on the Whistling Pines van for transportation. In my role as the Whistling Pines Recreation Director, I usually arrange weekly van trips for dining, shopping, and entertainment. During the third week of August, I provide daily 3-hour fair trips. For the staff, the fair is one of the most trying events of the year because we have to supply one helper for every 2 residents who require assistance or supervision. Lining up enough volunteers and staff to match up with pairs of residents is frustrating because any volunteer who chaperones one is unlikely to do it again. One volunteer put it best when she compared managing 2 retirees suffering from early Alzheimer's to herding squirrels suffering from ADHD. On top of the logistical headaches were other challenges. The forecasted morning fog would turn into high humidity, which some residents described as soft air. If the atmospheric inversion trapped a layer of hot air over the region, others described it as a prelude to hell. One challenge is keeping our charges hydrated. Many take diuretics to treat a high blood pressure, and they need to drink more than the average person, followed by the need to relieve themselves proportionately, sometimes with little warning. The chaperones are coached to carry extra water bottles and are given a map so they know a direct path to the nearest restroom from any point on the fairgrounds. The chaperones are also briefed on the dietary needs of their charges, which range from food allergies and diabetes to salt and cholesterol restrictions, which the residents often choose to ignore during a trip to the food barns, where local charities cater menus of comfort food like mashed potatoes and Swedish meatballs to calorie-laden cinnamon and sugar-dipped mini donuts. The Carnival Midway is also dotted with food trailers that offer tacos, fresh-squeezed lemonade, and funnel cakes that all appeal to folks who usually eat the nutritious but repetitious and bland diet served in the Whistling Pines dining room. The squirrel herding started shortly after breakfast when the residents lined up in the lobby to board the van on the first day of the fair. I checked off names from the sign-up sheet that would later help with head count when we made sure all who had been transported to the fair returned to Whistling Pines. I ticked off the names of the people in line and came up one short. "Has anyone seen High Sloan this morning?" I asked, surveying the senior citizens' faces for someone to give me a credible answer. "He was down for breakfast," a feeble female voice called from somewhere in the rear of the crowd as Wendy, the assistant director, and my drafted helper for the day, pulled the small van under the front portico. "Everyone saddle up," I told the group. "I'm running upstairs to get Hiram." I sprinted up the stairs and jogged to Hiram's room. There wasn't a big rush because 16 elderly people don't sprint onto a van, and at least one needed to have her wheelchair loaded with a hydraulic lift. At the same time, I was concerned that something had befallen Hiram. The muffled sounds of a television show emanated from Hiram's apartment, as they did from many of the other occupied rooms, so I knocked and called his name. I heard a grumbling reply and opened the unlocked door. Hiram was sitting in a recliner, staring at the television screen and stabbing the buttons on the remote control. "Hiram," I said, "it's time to go to the fair." He glared at me but turned off the television. "The fair doesn't start until Thursday." He held up a calendar he kept on a small table next to his chair. Large X's marked off the days, and the last marked day was Tuesday. "Today is Thursday," I said, pushing his walker in front of his chair. "Hmph," he muttered as he pushed himself to the edge of his huge recliner. "I missed the day somewhere along the line. I could have sworn it was only Wednesday." We arrived at the van just as Jenny Chapman, the nursing supervisor and my girlfriend, helped the last of the ladies up the van steps. "Can someone crank up the air conditioner?" a female voice asked from the rear of the van. "I'm starting to get heat stroke." I chuckled to myself as I guided Hiram up the steps. I'd been a Navy corpsman in Iraq, and even with high humidity, the Minnesota summers were cozy compared to the oven-like heat I'd experienced while serving in Iraq. I handed each of the chaperones a cloth shoulder bag embroidered with the Whistling Pines logo, containing 3 bottles of water, and reminded them to keep their charges hydrated and to watch for signs of heat stroke. My 2 squirrels this year were Henry Tinker Oldham, a one-time farmer and the town handyman, and Brad Tubby Nordquist, who acquired his nickname by being the fattest kid in school from first grade on. The responsibility of keeping them both in sight while keeping them safe, hydrated, and cool was daunting, We spent half an hour walking through the 4-H handicraft displays and then exited near the livestock exhibits. I gave each of them a swig of water as we started through the cattle barn. Tinker toddled through while Tubby lumbered along, pulling his oxygen bottle, stopping at every 12x12 pen, pretending to examine the cow or calf while catching his breath. "I want to see the draft horses," Tinker said as he waited impatiently for Tubby. "When I was logging, I used a team of Belgian horses to pull stumps and drag logs. Those were some fine horses. Their hooves don't break up the roots in the forest like those big skidders with caterpillar treads they use today." As Tinker started for the horse barn, I hung back and watched Tubby wipe his brow with a sodden red bandana while pretending to assess the quality of a Hereford calf that was barely a day old, tottering on untried legs and bawling for his mother. The smell of sweet fresh hay mingled with pungent manure and permeated everything. In the corner of one stall, a group of teenage 4-H members were playing crazy eights using straw bales as a table and chairs. For many of the rural kids, the county fair was the social event of the year, and many spent the nights catching a few hours of sleep in the stalls near the cattle while overindulging in the excitement of the competition and the fair. For some, it was the first night they'd ever spent away from parents and home. It was rumored that some experienced their first kiss at the fair, finally away from the constant supervision and work embodied by life on a farm. Ahead of us, a teenaged boy was preparing a huge black Angus bull for judging in his pen. Although Angus cattle tend to be docile, people give bulls a wide berth. Tinker, with hearing aids off to conserve their batteries and oblivious to the behemoth in the pen just ahead of him, continued walking toward the horse barn. I unsuccessfully tried to speed up Tubby. Finally, dropping my bag of water and leaving him behind, I made a dash for Tinker, hoping to steer him to the far side of the aisle before he tried to pass the bull's pen. I froze in place about 5 feet away when Tinker, still focused on getting to the horses, reached the pen just as the behemoth suddenly started bucking like a rodeo bull. Before his young handler gained control of the animal, the bull bumped against the wooden gate. I watched in horror as the gate flew open and smashed into Tinker. By the time I got to Tinker, his eyes were rolled back and his breath was coming in short rasps. Seeing blood frothing in his mouth, I knelt by Tinker's side and ran my hands over his chest, quickly assessing his condition. Through his thin chest muscles, I felt 3 ribs that were probably broken. The pink froth on his lips told me that at least one of his ribs had punctured a lung, and depending upon the severity of the injury, there was a chance he'd die, possibly before an ambulance arrived. A quick-thinking farmer dialed 911, and within a minute, a volunteer EMT, first aid bag slung over her shoulder, came running into the barn. The young woman in a blue uniform with an EMT patch knelt next to me, and I told her the patient was Henry Oldham, a resident at Whistling Pines. I gave my quick assessment of his medical condition and stepped aside so she could do her job. I quickly checked on Tubby, then watched the EMT examine Tinker for contusions and lacerations before listening to his chest. With the stethoscope still in her ears, she looked at me and shook her head, which indicated his chest sounds were not good. She put an oxygen cannula under his nose and turned her head to talk into a radio mic on her shoulder. I heard the words "extremely critical," the rest being lost in the cacophony around her. She held his hand and spoke softly to him until a stretcher arrived to cart Tinker to a waiting ambulance. The Lake County Sheriff, Bill Lottie, who'd spent the day in a campaign booth shaking hands in preparation for the November election, showed up as Tubby asked me for the third time, "What happened?" A bull hip-checked the gate and it flew into Tinker, I explained for the third time, trying hard not to let my frustration crack through. The sheriff was conferring with his deputies when I tapped him on the shoulder. "Excuse me, I was with the man who was injured." The sheriff let out a sigh, put on his best campaign smile, and turned to me. "Can you hang on for a moment? I need to speak with my deputies." "I saw the whole thing," I said. "I was trying to catch Tinker when the gate hit him." Deputy Ron Harris, a burly, middle-aged cop I'd met previously, stepped forward and directed me away from the sheriff's huddle. "I'll take your statement in a minute. Right now, we're doing an accident investigation." "Deputy Harris," I said, "I'm Peter Rogers from Whistling Pines, the retirement community. Do you remember me from Axel Olson's murder?" Recognition dawned on Harris's face. "Yep, you tried to keep us from looking at the crime scene. Sure, I remember you." "The injured man is one of the Whistling Pines residents. His name is Henry Oldham." Tubby tugged at my sleeve. "What happened?" he asked again. Deputy Harris patted Tubby on the arm and said, "Your friend Henry was injured by a bull. He's in pretty bad shape." "Who are you?" Tubby asked. "I'm Deputy Harris from the Sheriff's Department." "I don't have a friend named Henry," Tubby replied. "I was here with Tinker." Harris gave me a questioning look. I responded by explaining that Tinker is Henry's nickname. "Can we get this show on the road?" Tubby asked. "I need to sit down." In the pen beside us, a red-headed girl was grooming a red Angus calf the same color as her hair. She was trying to appear disinterested while sneaking furtive looks at the hubbub. "Excuse me, could we borrow your chair?" I asked her. Her name tag said Megan. With her hair tied in a ponytail and her freckled face, she looked no more than 14 years old. She went quickly to the corner and carried a folding canvas camp chair to me. Tubby sat down hard and looked tired. "Does your father need a drink of water, too?" Megan asked. "That would be very nice, thank you," I replied, having misplaced my bag of bottled water during the commotion. Megan hurried to a cooler in the corner of the stall and pulled out a milk jug. She poured water into a Dixie cup she took from a stack standing on the railing. I had a sinking feeling thinking about the germ content of non-chlorinated well water stored in a plastic milk jug poured into a cup that had been sitting in the open pen. Salmonella and E. coli came to mind, but I tempered that with the knowledge that Megan had probably been drinking it for a day and was showing no ill effects. I handed the cup to Tubby, who drank greedily. "Megan, did you see what happened?" I asked. Deputy Harris moved to the railing to hear her response. I don't know. It all happened kind of fast." "Do you know the boy who was leading the bull?" Harris asked. Megan's face flushed, and she looked down the aisle to where a good-looking teenage boy, maybe 2 years older than Megan, was talking to one of the deputies. She quickly looked at her shoes. "His name is Tony Benson," she replied. The flush didn't fade. "He was working with his bull in the pen. Do you know what happened?" I asked. "He was getting Cosmo ready for the show ring," she replied. "Then Cosmo went kind of nuts and started bucking and kicking." "Does Cosmo go nuts often?" I asked. Megan shrugged, looked furtively at a pen across the aisle, and said, "I don't think so. The Bensons live a couple miles down the road, but I'm not over there much. They raise Angus, which are pretty docile, not like the Charolais that can be mean." "Did something happen that made Cosmo go nuts?" Harris asked. Again, Megan flushed. "I think someone shot him." "Shot him?" I asked. "I didn't hear a gunshot." "Not with a gun. He was shot with a binder," she said, making a motion like she was drawing back a rubber band and then releasing it. "Someone shot him with a rubber band and he started kicking?" Harris asked skeptically. Megan nodded in response. "Where did the rubber band hit, Cosmo?" I asked. Megan was in full red distress now, with the flush creeping up her neck and onto her freckled face. Even the scalp under the part through her hair was red. She leaned across the top rail of the pen and whispered to us, "It hit his equipment." I looked around and estimated that the bucket serving as her calf grooming chair put her at eye level with the equipment in the neighboring pen. "Did you see who shot Cosmo?" I asked, trying to lead the conversation into territory that might be more comfortable for Megan. "I'm not sure. I was kind of looking at Cosmo. I just saw the rubber band falling, and Cosmo went gonzo." Harris thanked her and took her name and phone number while I looked among the mixed straw and bedding that littered the aisle between the pens. In less than a minute, I saw a bit of red peeking through some scattered straw. I carefully pushed the straw aside with my toe, exposing a heavy rubber band like the ones used to hold bunches of broccoli together in the grocery store. It was nearly a quarter inch wide and about 4 inches in diameter. A rubber band of that size had quite a bit of stretch and a fair amount of momentum if it were fully stretched. I wouldn't want to be hit in the arm with it, not to mention my equipment. There was no wonder that Cosmo reacted to the impact. "Deputy Harris, can you come over here for a moment?" I asked, interrupting his interview of a nearby teenage boy who was in the pen across from Megan. As Harris approached, I squatted down and pointed to the rubber band. "Look what I found inside the bull's pen." Harris considered the rubber band and then looked at me skeptically. "Do you think this really hit Cosmo?" I think Megan was too embarrassed to have made up this story, and this is roughly where Cosmo was standing when he started bucking. I paused and saw that Harris was still skeptical, but I pointed to the scuff marks made by Cosmo's kicking hooves on the rough cement floor. "How much pain would this cause to your equipment?" I asked. "Stand here," Harris said, before disappearing into a mass of people. Since the crowd had broken up once the EMT left, there was little for me to do except swat at the thousands of flies that were attracted by the cattle and manure. I tried to visualize where someone would stand to shoot a rubber band meant to hit Cosmo. Depending on the strength of the shooter, the range of the binder was probably less than 10 or 15 feet, and to get the angle, the shooter had to be standing in an arc of less than 30 degrees in the aisle directly behind the bull's pen. I looked around the floor and saw at least a dozen other red rubber bands among the straw in the aisle. I quickly surmised that the shooter had been practicing for a while before his shot went between the wood slats and connected with Cosmo's equipment. In less than a minute, Harris was back, and I pointed out other rubber bands. "I think our shooter was practicing for a while before he connected with Cosmo. Considering what happened, he's probably at the top of the Ferris wheel right now." "The sheriff thinks it's a prank gone awry," Harris said. "We don't have time to hunt down a rubber binder sharpshooter." I tried to protest, but he waved me off, and I went back to tending Tubby, who was fidgeting in his chair. "Is something wrong?" I asked. "I got a pee," Tubby replied. "It's those damned water pills." His efforts to push himself from the canvas chair were foiled by the soft chair arms that sagged as he pushed. I positioned myself at his side and lifted his arm as he pushed with the other. With wobbling legs, he stood staring at the end of the barn, the aisle crowded with fairgoers. The door leading to the restrooms was some 50 feet distant. "I can't make it that far," he said, with beads of sweat forming on his brow as his breath quickened. "Get me over to the corner of the pen where the post will hide me." "I don't think that's a good idea." Ignoring me, Tubby shuffled to the far corner and pulled his fly open. Before I could intervene, urine was splashing on the concrete floor and straw bedding. The combination of the diuretics and prostate problems made this an excruciatingly slow process, and it drew the attention of everyone in the area, including poor Megan, who got a front-row view of the show. Again, the part in her hair was glowing from embarrassment while she tried to busy herself with her calf. Tubby zipped up and shuffled back to the chair, blissfully unaware of the scene he'd created. He fell more than sat in the chair and tried to catch his breath. "Phew, that was close," he said with a wheeze. Deputy Harris was frowning and shaking his head. Tubby saw his reaction and puckered his face. "Listen, sonny, just wait until your prostate swells up to the size of a softball." Deputy Harris sighed, then nodded to the end of the aisle where the sheriff was speaking with the EMT supervisor and said to me, "The sheriff would like to talk to you." I made sure Tubby was comfortable, then walked across the aisle to the sheriff. "I'm afraid I can't be much help. I was trying to get Tubby moving along when I saw Tinker moving close to the bull." The sheriff waved off my comments. "I understand you're responsible for leading the Whistling Pines group around the fair. It's our outing for the week. We come here with several groups every year. Whistling Pines is that nursing home where the old guy got stabbed last spring, isn't it?" "Actually, Whistling Pines isn't a nursing home. Our residents live independently, and we provide meals and other services we call assisted living." "Deputy Harris reminded me that you helped Len Rentz solve that murder," the sheriff said, referring to the Two Harbors police chief. "Well, I asked a bunch of questions, but they didn't seem to go anywhere. I didn't know where the conversation was going, but I had a sinking feeling that I was going to get roped into something. Len also told me that when your crazy old neighbor was shooting at rabbits in her backyard, you ran toward the shots. Most people either ran away or their legs turned to jello. There really wasn't much chance that she was going to hit anything. Well, not anything that she was aiming for. Len Rentz said that you were very professional. You impressed him." "Thanks," was the only word I could offer. "I heard you were thinking about a career in criminal justice." "A long time ago, I was thinking about law enforcement, but I decided to be a recreation director." "Did you pass the post exam?" he asked, referring to the eligibility test to be a sworn police officer. "I did, but my life..." I thought back to the rides with Len Rentz when he tried to convince me to pursue a job with the Two Harbors Police. "My life had taken a different turn since then. That was over 5 years ago. It's only valid for 1 year," I reminded him. The sheriff appraised me like the cattle in the judging ring. I wasn't as buff as I'd been in Iraq, but I was still 6 feet tall and carried about 190 pounds without any paunch. "We're down a deputy, and you have the military bearing that makes a deputy effective. Why don't you stop by the courthouse and fill out an application? I appreciate your offer, but like I said, I like the contribution I make at Whistling Pines." The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.